All statements and opinions expressed by guests of the Adult in the Room podcast are strictly their own and do not necessarily reflect the beliefs or opinions of the host, producers, or advertisers. All interviews are presented in their most complete possible form in the interests of free speech. No statements should be interpreted as financial, legal, or medical advice. Listener and viewer discretion are strongly advised.
It's the Adult in the Room podcast with Victoria Taft. That's me.
Welcome to the Adult in the Room podcast with Victoria Taft. How are you? Well, Jeffrey Stevens is in the studio and on the pod today. He is a novelist and an attorney. He's written 8 published novels, which is pretty doggone good. He's been writing since he was a kid, and he writes in my favorite genre, the spy thriller. And his latest book is called Enemies Among Us, which is a sequel to The Handler in his Nicholas Reagan series. Protagonist Reagan is a CIA spook. I've just discovered his book, so I can't believe what a slacker I am. I mean, I know you've all read him, but I'm new to this particular author, and I'm very much looking forward to interviewing him today. So, as many spy thrillers do, the plot line of Jeffrey Stevens' latest book reads as if it's a presidential daily brief. It's ripped from the headlines, but it's probably deeper than just ripped from the headlines. Stories ignored by the machine media, they don't show those stories. Those are the ones you don't see, but the media are in the thrall of the intelligence community. And this is one of the reasons why you don't see all the stories that we do. But anyway, yeah. So one of the things that I always say, wait, you mean the intelligence community is involved with the news media? Which of course it is. And if you don't know that, you are not paying attention. But once you do see it, you will not unsee it. For example, wait, you mean the first Watergate break-in was a CIA op, and then they just let Nixon twist in the wind? Why, yes. Yes, they did. And wait a minute now. Hold on. The CIA started the Trump-Russia collusion fakery, and then they were just going to let him twist in the wind and make him out to be a really bad guy? Why, yes. Yes, they were, and yes, they did. Is the CIA just doing more black ops stuff in the U.S., or are we just noticing it more because we can't unsee it? We're better at recognizing it. Yes and yes. And so telling a story with a CIA spook protagonist might be getting a little bit more difficult these days. But Jeffrey Stevens has navigated it very, very well in his second Nicholas Reagan novel, Enemies Among Us, which could give you a plot clue on what's going on in the book. Welcome, Jeffrey Stevens, to the Adult in the Room podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
I'm delighted you're here. Thank you so much for coming. I really appreciate it. And I guess we'll start with where I ended. Is it harder making a CIA spook the good guy in a book series these days?
Wow, what a great question. That's a good start. No and yes. So Nick Reagan and his partner, Carol Gellows, are true patriots. And that was my starting point when I began the first book, which is The Handler, as you so kindly mentioned. And The Handler is more, I would call it a traditional globe-trotting espionage novel based on a lot of facts, based on a lot of things that I know about, based on people that I've met and so forth. And when I wrote it, one of the funny parts of the story, Victoria, is that my publisher came to me and said, and he's published other books for me, he said, do you really want to write a book about terrorism? I mean, isn't that kind of like passé? And I said, no, pal, let me tell you something. You don't know what the intelligence community does every day to protect us. It's just like the military who need to be adored and honored and respected for what they do. Well, the intelligence community and the people who live in the shadows, basically, they're stopping plots against us all the time that we never know about. So I wrote the book, and it got a great reaction. And then, unfortunately, the world exploded, and we see that terrorism is still very much alive. Witness Hamas, witness what's going on from Iran, and so on. And so that brings us to the second book. And so this time I said, I want to write something a little bit closer to home because as you have so correctly said, there's so much going on that, and I know this is a rather trite phrase, but part of the points of enemies among us is it's tough to tell the good guys from the bad guys. And the key is, who can you trust in this environment? And I don't care. I want to get this out of the way right from the beginning. I don't care what side of the aisle you're on. I don't care if you're an independent. Yeah, I don't care if you're a liberal conservative. I don't care if you like Biden or Trump. It doesn't matter. These are real life issues that we're dealing with every day. And sometimes we don't even know that. And so it was very exciting. And the book, this is one of, you said I've got 8 published novels, and it's true. And I have to tell you, this one, I would say, was the easiest to write on many levels, or one of the 2 easiest to write, because things are happening so quickly. And so I had a great time writing this book, and it's a lot of fun.
You were initially, I think, beckoned to this genre by a CIA friend of yours or acquaintance. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, you have such a good memory. Yes. The original character is based on someone I knew, and it was a funny story. And if you have time, I'll tell you the story.
But yeah.
I didn't know he had anything to do with it. He was a former Green Beret. Uh-huh. And back in our single days in New York City, we hung out together. And do you want me to tell you the story about how this all happened?
Absolutely. We've got time.
People, I tell you, your listeners aren't going to believe this, but this is a true story. As they say, you got to believe this. So anyway, we were coming back from the Hamptons, which is what, you know, we
of
all
course
did
you were.
In a day. Right? I mean, we were young. And he said, let's go back early on a Sunday. And what we'll do is we'll go uptown to the bar where we knew the owner, where there was a piano player there, and it was fun, and we knew a lot of the men and women who hung out there, whatever. So I said, okay, fine. So he had a car at the time, and my car, I think, was in the shop or something. So we drove back from the Hamptons, and he lived in this high-rise on the East River. And so we get there. He said, come on, let's go upstairs. We'll clean up. We'll change, and we'll go uptown. I said, fantastic. So we get off the elevator, and he was on something like, I want to say, the 23rd floor in the skyscraper. And as we get off the elevator, I'm telling you, people, I know you're going to say I'm making this up. At the end of the hallway is a guy standing there in the shadows in a trench coat at the end of the court. And my friend's face, let's call him Skip, okay, the nickname, let's just say Skip. His entire face changed. Now, he was about 8 or 10 years older than I. I was like early 20s. He was early 30s. And he said, hold on for a minute. And he walks down to the end of the hallway, and I hear murmur, 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 you know? And I'm thinking to myself, this is how naive I was. I'm thinking, why is a guy wearing a trench coat in August? This is central casting. Skip comes back down, and he says to me, listen, grab a cab and go back to your place. I can't really go out tonight. I got something I got to do. And I didn't hear from him for 2 weeks. He didn't come out to the Hamptons for the next weekend. A bunch of young people that we were, you know, guys and girls, moved to his house out in West Hampton and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, 2 weeks go by. He shows up again. Hey, how are you doing? Let's go play some tennis. Let's do whatever. You know, I said, wait a minute. Let's go have a drink first. So I said, okay, listen, you know, as they say, I was born at night, but it wasn't last night. So you're going to tell me what this was about. And he told me, and he said, here's the deal. You know, when I came back from the service, I went to work in the corporate sector. I won't say what corporation he worked for, but it was a big multinational corporation. And he got tapped on the shoulder, and he said, with your experience and your background and where you are now, you're a perfect guy to be giving us some help internationally. And he went to work for the CIA. Now, I want to be clear. He never told me state secrets. He didn't, you know, tell me who killed JFK. I mean, it wasn't like anything like that. But he did tell me a lot about how everything worked. Okay, so now, if I'm not boring you yet,
No, you're not.
Okay, so here's the connection. So when I was writing books, I wrote my whole life, as you said, I wrote since I was a kid, but I didn't do much about getting published until like 20 years ago. I had a couple of books, and one day I'm with some people, and one friend says to the other, you know, Bob, you're a literary agent, and Jeff is a writer. Did you know that? No, ha, ha, ha. And he said, well, what have you got? Send me your book. So I sent him this book. It was my favorite book by far. I loved it. He loved it. He said, this is it. Your career is going to take off from this. I said, fantastic. He couldn't sell it for 20 cents. He couldn't sell it at all. Nobody was buying the book. It didn't fit into an obvious genre. It wasn't espionage. It wasn't romance. It wasn't a mystery. Anyway, I was very disappointed. And he said, what else have you got? I said, well, I have this book that I wrote about a CIA agent who you don't know he's an agent at first. And then as the story develops, you find out that he's dark ops and so forth. Black ops, I should say more correctly. And he said, well, let me see. Boom. He sold it in a second and it got published. And that was the beginning. And so I start to write this series about these CIA agents. The other book ultimately did get published, I must tell you, somewhere along the way.
I figured it would have been.
Yeah, but the CIA stories have gone on. And so this new character, Nick Reagan and Carol Gellos, I'm very fond of them as characters. They're very real life. It's not like every minute's in a tuxedo swilling martini. I love James Bond, right. Don't get me wrong. But this is more gritty and more realistic. And it really gets into, Enemies Among Us really gets into what's going on in the world right now. In Washington, the people who we think are our friends running the country, the people at the head of big industry, what they're doing, this whole one world philosophy of the open borders, big pharma, how it all ties in together. And as I say, I had a ball writing the book and people are loving it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. And that's the first one of yours I've read. And I really enjoyed it. I will go back and read all of them in the different universes that you oversee. And so, but I wonder, whatever happened to your CIA buddy?
Oh, I'm sorry to say he passed a couple of years ago. We remained friends all the years. And then he had some illnesses, which I believe, by the way, originated from his work as a Green Beret, not for the CIA, but you know, they were exposed to so many things, Agent Orange and all these different diseases and so forth. And he passed on, but he was a tremendous guy. He was smart. He was loyal and he was a patriot to the absolute end. The guy, he's buried in Arlington with honors and star on the wall at Langley and never to be spoken of again, unfortunately, but you know, I'll remember him forever, as will his friends and the people who worked with him. And those are the people that we never hear about, who are the people who are actually protecting us every day. Do you remember the movie? It's got a great scene in it, A Few Good Men, with Tom Cruise and Jack Nicholson. And there's a great scene because Jack Nicholson, of course, plays the villain. But there's a great scene when he's on the stand and he said, while you're sleeping in your bed tonight, we're standing on the wall defending this country, defending your honor, protecting you, and you want us on that wall. And you know something? Even though he was in the villain in the movie, he was telling the truth, because these are the people who we count on whether we know it or not.
Right. In your novel, this latest one, you talk about those people on the wall and what they're willing to do, but you also have mixed in your storytelling the people who maybe ordinarily used to be good guys, like pharma and people in business, who turn out to be in some form or fashion not entirely good guys anymore. They're looking for power. They're looking for advantage. Can you talk a little bit about that? And please include in your answer what power is, because I think people don't quite understand what that is.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. You know, here's the thing about all that. First of all, good guys, bad guys, nobody, with a few exceptions, you could say like Hitler was completely evil, let's say. But if you go all the way back in history, not to get too religious, I mean, I'm a Christian, I believe in God, and I understand that Judas was a bad guy, but he wasn't all bad. You know,
he hung around for an awfully long time with Jesus.
The penultimate moment came, and they just had enough silver for him. That's right. And after he betrayed him, he couldn't live with that fact. So the point is, huge majority of people are neither all good nor all evil. But as the saying goes, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And what we've got in our society is, we used to be, just to go back for a second, I know this is going to sound a little pedantic, but America began...
Hey, wait a minute. Can I stop you here?
Yes.
You say it's going to sound a little pedantic. One of the things I love about your writing is that you don't sound pedantic.
Thank you.
You don't over-explain.
I don't
preach. Elegantly. You don't preach. It's awesome. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. So here's what I want to say. When we look back at the history of our country began as an agrarian society. So the key was, who grew crops? Who raised cows? You know, this is what the currency was, you know, even before paper money came into play, right? And then came the Industrial Revolution, and suddenly people started to morph into living into cities and working in factories, and that was important. And then trains and oil became the key, because you had needed the transportation across the country, you needed the oil to run these things, and so on and so on and so on. And then later on, we came into, and I'm jumping forward, we came into the intelligence age. And right now, what controls this country? TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, Elon Musk. Well, like, don't get me wrong, but these people who are in the intelligence community, that's what's running things. And Big Pharma is a big part of that, because don't kid yourself, folks, those vaccines that came through so quickly and some doctors did some wonderful stuff. Remember, Pfizer and the rest of them, Moderna, they made a bloody fortune out of the COVID crisis. They made a bloody fortune. And those are the people who are really controlling things. They pulled the strings. The George Soros and the Koch brothers. Again, I don't care which side of the aisle you're on, but those are the people who are running this country, because they're the ones who are funding everything. And we have to be realistic about that. Now, the second part is, and this is really an interesting part, because people tend, that I talk to, not to think about this. We think that we elect our congressmen and our senators, and ultimately we elect our president, right? All good. Now, there are incredibly large bureaucracies in this country. I'm talking about CIA, FBI, the NSA, the Social Security Administration, on and on and on. Who runs those things? Do career people who came up from the ranks, who really understand those bureaucracies, did they run them? Oh, no, 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 no. Politicians appoint them. So we, the American people, remember that in the Declaration of Independence, we the people, we do not get to choose who runs these things. So you get people in there who are very often political hacks. I'm sorry to say this, no offense to anybody. They're intelligent people, but they don't have the experience that people who worked in these things for 10 and 20 and 30 years understand, and yet they get to run it. And some of them are corrupt. Some of them are stupid. Some of them are swayed by the money that's available to them, like if you're the head of the FDA. I'm not saying the head of the FDA is taking bribes. That's not my point. My point is there are questions that we have to have answered that a lot of people aren't asking. So isn't that interesting that we get to elect our local representatives, our congressmen, our senators, and even the president, and yet the hugest bureaucracies that affect our lives are run by political appointees.
Or at NGOs, or the people we don't elect are the people they cede authority to under their auspices, but then they don't really check on much on the grants that they give out, or they, you've got stuff going on right now at the border run by, I've looked at the list of NGOs. I can't make head or tails out of them. I can't figure out who's who and who's what. It's insane. It's hard. It's Byzantine. And to report on that is difficult, but
it really is.
They're running the show.
It's sad.
And they don't like America. And a lot of them don't like America. You know?
No, exactly right. A lot of them believe that we should be the World Economic Forum, George Soros. These people believe there should be a one world economy, that borders and ethnicity and history shouldn't matter, and that they should all be running it, that you should be run by this elite group of very wealthy people. But that's not the deal. That's not what America's based on. And it's not fair. And there are wealthy people who agree with me, like Elon Musk, for example, agrees with me. But the fact of the matter is that too many people are out there. So it's kind of scary. And it's kind of scary what people do, what Big Pharma does to get drugs authorized early so that they can make money from it.
So and then you're saying,
by the way, excuse the interruption, but then they have this great excuse. They say, well, we need to make that money because that's how we fund research and development for drugs that are for very minor diseases that these people, come on, folks, wake up. This is there.
A lot of R&D. I think it takes over six million. Oh, it's not. I don't even know. It's millions and millions and millions of dollars to get a drug approved through the FDA. So
that's true. And
that's
why
that's a lot of R&D.
So don't bother me for baking $1 billion or billions of dollars on the vaccines, because we needed to do that so we could fund these other things. But the fact is, you still have to be accountable to the American people. And that's what we're looking for. And the leadership that we once had in this country doesn't exist anymore. You mentioned the Nixon thing and Watergate and everything.
Did you know that?
Yeah.
Did you know that the first Watergate break-in was at the CIA op?
Of course.
People don't understand that. And he did not, Nixon did not authorize it. I worked as a docent at the Nixon Library, which I've mentioned a million times back in the, you know, just a few years ago when we lived in SoCal, and it was awesome. And, I'll just volunteer here. I learned so much more about Richard Nixon, but I'll tell you one thing. They don't talk about that.
No,
oh, no. No, no,
no, no, they don't.
NARA does not talk about that.
They don't. And I read a fabulous book recently. I'm not going to remember the name, folks. I'm sorry. But if you look it up, anyway, the theory that the CIA was behind the assassination of Kennedy because the industrial military complex did not want a Cold War. They felt that we were still in a position to win a hot war with Russia. And Kennedy was working through back channels to bring a peace with Khrushchev, you know, peaceful coexistence and all that sort of thing. And they didn't like that a bit. And that's why they got rid of Kennedy, because they felt Johnson would work with them more. And P.S., look what happened in Vietnam. So I don't know. Is it true? Is it not true? This guy had a lot of facts to back him up. But again, we need to know, we need to have leaders who inspire us. In my lifetime, there are only two presidents I can honestly say inspired me to be an American. One was a Democrat, that was Kennedy, and the other was a Republican, it was Reagan. They made me feel good about being an American. All the rest of them were just politicians.
Yeah. You could tell they feel, well, even if John Kennedy didn't feel it, I think he did. But who will go along with the idea that ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country? I mean, where is that ethic right now? Where is that in America?
Great question, Victoria. Yeah, where is it?
I don't see it. Let's talk about, let's go back to the initial question, which was in what form does power take? And you talked about money and you talked about influence. You talked about information. Those are all very, very powerful things. Now, you laughed when I mentioned, because you laughed knowingly, that when I mentioned the fact that the IC essentially runs the news media, or clearly they do. I mean, how did they plant the Russia, Russia, Russia story? I mean, for God's sake. And I mean, it was just absurd. I'm sure the P tape for the germaphobe, who's the president. Okay. Sure. I mean, it's just absurd. But nevertheless, you've got a bunch of the Kendallanians of the world that will believe it and they'll print it. Okay. So to what extent do you think they run things? I mean, in the Twitter files, one more thing, overlay, so I can let you go and cut you loose. We found out that in a social media company, so many of those people are former FBI, former justice lawyers, former CIA or current CIA. Are you ever really a former CIA guy? And they're all there in the seventh floor, the big corner office at the social media companies. They've infiltrated like a tick in these entities. Yeah, the CIA owns they're in Silicon Valley and they own a angel investor firm. I mean, they're there and they're investing in all of these different
technologies. You're right. Well said.
So here we are. They are infiltrated in Silicon Valley. They're infiltrated in the major legacy media. And we are just getting played.
Yes, we are. You're absolutely right. I mean, what else can you say? The people who are in the positions of power are the people with money who control the flow of information, who are tapped into politicians whom they own. I know that sounds very trite, but it's true. I don't want to pick on anybody in particular, but you know who we're talking about. Look at the Biden family. Oh. How Biden has been in government for 50 years. Where did he get all this money from? I mean, how does he have all these houses and all this money? And no one thinks that's curious. I mean, Donald Trump, say what you will about the guy. I know a lot of people don't like him. Donald Trump.
Donald Trump.
He's the only president I can remember who lost money by becoming president. Obama couldn't pay for a shoe shine, and now he's a multimillionaire. Mm-hmm. And you know, how did that happen? Come on.
I tell my husband that all the time. Just take a look at the people who walk out poorer than when they went in, and those are the people who probably worked for us.
That's right. That's right. Look at Nancy Pelosi and the insider trading she's accused of. And and her dopey husband, who somehow always had the information he needed to make the right trade. I mean, it's just so obvious.
You've approached this from a couple of different ways. First of all, you knew a CIA spook. You guys talked, but he didn't give away state secrets. Okay. Then you're also an attorney. And I think you are now a former recovering attorney, if I'm not mistaken. But what kind of an attorney were you, and how does that inform your writing?
Okay. Well, please don't tell my clients, because they still practice law.
Okay.
Yes, it's okay. It's okay. I don't mind. I like a recovering attorney. I'll use that line. I began as a litigator in New York. I was in New York City. I was a young guy. I went on my own, which was sort of like not done back then anymore. Everybody was with a big firm, and all my friends were with the big firms. And I said, no, I want to practice on my own. I want to write. I want to do different things. And so I did that. And I morphed into a practice where I did transactional things. I represented some clients. One of my claims to fame, as my friends like to say, is that I represented Martha Stewart when she was a caterer. And we created the magazine, the TV show, and all that. And then I left before she got in trouble. And I always felt bad that she got in trouble, but she was represented by corporate lawyers who I feel, you know, maybe
trot her out and just make her, you know, admit to a couple of wrongdoing.
Yeah,
I
don't want to accuse anybody. It wasn't well handled. And I love Martha, and she's a very, very tough woman. And if she were a man, everyone would have said, God, what a tough guy. And because she's a woman, you know what they called her.
And yes, of course.
It wasn't right, because she's driven. She is hardworking. And, you know, it was a pleasure to be involved in that universe for that time. And I represented some other people. And so I got more and more into business deals, which made it easier for me to write. Because one of the problems with litigation is your calendar is not your own. For anybody who's out there who knows this, you know, the court says you got to come in tomorrow for a hearing. And I said, but wait a minute, I'm in the middle of an important chapter, you know. If a client is buying a building, you say, okay, I'll call you in the afternoon. But in any event.
So that helps. I think in some way that helps you, right? Because then people who get things done are the busiest people, right? So maybe that just gave you the impetus. Well, let me ask you this. Now, you are now a current attorney with lots of clients in the New York, Connecticut area. You live in Connecticut, and you're not too far from, you know, the big house and where everything happens. What did you make of the Trump fines in this Manhattan trial? What'd you think of that?
I'm not so sure. Like you say, I'm close to the big house.
Oh yeah, no, I'm sorry.
In prison.
That sounded bad. Sorry.
I am not privy to the inside information there. That case I regard as one of the greatest travesties in the history of my career as an attorney that I've ever witnessed. Because you had a judge from the beginning who said, "I hate Donald Trump," and basically, right? He didn't like Trump, and he felt he was guilty right from the beginning. Then they imposed a fine using a statute that, 120 years, and it's never been used to impose a statute like that. Then you've got no victims. So exactly who did he hurt? Well, he hurt the system. I mean, what a bunch of baloney. But here's the thing. I've done a lot of very, very big real estate deals. Very big, as Donald would say, huge. But anyway, and I want to tell you, this is how it works. If I come to you and I say, Victoria, I've got this building. It's worth $100 million. I want to borrow $60 million against it. And you're a bank, and you say to me, Jeff, I love you. Sure. Let's talk about it. What is the first thing Victoria does? You hire an appraiser. You don't take my word for the value of the building. You hire an appraiser. And then you come back and you say, Jeff, you know, I know that you said your building was worth $100 million, but you know what? The fact of the matter is, our appraiser said it's worth $60 million, so the most we could lend you is $30. That's how the world works. And I've done deal after deal. This is so ridiculous that somehow he fooled someone by claiming it. Then the second part of this is, I'm traveling right now, and I'm in Florida. Hello, everybody. I'm in sunny Florida. And I'm right down the road, so to speak, from Mar-a-Lago. And they claim Mar-a-Lago was only $18 million and Donald Trump inflated the value. Let me tell you something. I am not a hugely wealthy guy, but I will buy Mar-a-Lago tomorrow for double the $18 million. It's so ridiculous to say that it's not worth $18 million. They're selling houses in Palm Beach for $18 million. This thing is an estate that runs from water to water. I mean, it's mind-boggling. And yet, you're in New York State, and so no one is coming to the fore. And I just wish, you know, I'm trying to think, since it's been going on, I've been physically ill over how upsetting this is. But I just wish there were some road to go directly to the Supreme Court and say, this man is being tarred and feathered in a legal system gone amok, and you guys need to shut this down and say it's wrong. But we have to go through all of this stuff, and it's just crazy. The system is so fractured that he has to put up with this. I tell you, I was on, I don't know if your listeners will appreciate this story, but anyway, since we're talking about Donald Trump, and whether you like him or not, look, he's a tough guy. And so several months ago, maybe it was, I don't know, October or something like that, I was down in Florida and I was with a friend of mine who was not a golfer. So we couldn't go out to play. So we went to the driving range. And anybody who's out there who knows, when you can't play golf, what do? You go to the driving range. So we're going to hit balls, and we're out there hitting balls. And I knew that President Trump was on the property that day. I knew that because I could feel Secret Service, whatever. But it's late afternoon. There's nobody on the driving range except for my friend Rick and me. And all of a sudden, I feel this cart come behind me, and it's Donald Trump. And he pulls up in the slot right beside me, and he gets out. And I say, Mr. President, how are you doing? He said, I need to work on my short game. I'm going to hit some shots over here to the over. I said, great. You know, well, we get into a whole conversation. I said, you know, I met him before. I reminded him. And you know, the guy's met 20 million people. So he said, oh, yeah, I remind you. So he's probably full of baloney, but he remembers me, whatever, whatever. We wound up having a 15-minute conversation about foreign policy, about what's going on in the country and all this sort of stuff. And it's true story. And my friend was taking pictures. My friend was in shock. I'm talking to the president, but I said, what the heck? This is my opportunity. Change the course of American history, right? This is it.
Don't blow your shot, man.
At the end of the conversation, I said to him, I want to just say one thing, Mr. President, and I hope you accept this from me in the spirit in which I'm saying it. He said, what's that? Because we really had a nice conversation, mm-hmm. and very civil and very interesting. I said, you are the toughest effing guy in the United States of America. And as soon as I used the F-bomb, I could see the Secret Service guy off to the side kind of reach for his pistol. He's like, and I said, no, I want to say this again. You are the toughest effing guy in the United States of America. No one could put up with what they've been throwing at you for 7 years. It's unbelievable that you have the fortitude to deal with the legal issues they throw at you, the bad press, the media that says all these horrible things about you that aren't true. And I just want you to know that whatever happens, there are people who appreciate that you're in this game for us, because other people come into politics to make a fortune. You came into politics risking your fortune, and you did it for America, whether people think that so or not. And he just looked at me and he said, God bless you for saying that. And he got in his car and he drove away. And that's who the guy is. And people don't see
that.
What
are the chances of that happening?
Yeah, no, but people don't see that side of him. They see him, oh, he's, you know, talking about himself and he's an egomaniac and he's against abortion and what, you know, whatever the story is for that day. But the truth of the matter is he was really touched, and, you know, and we talked about a lot of things that were going on and everything. And, you know, he's not going to make me his ambassador to Italy anytime soon. I understand that.
Darn it.
But, although it would be nice. I'd love to be in Italy.
Sure.
But the idea is that people don't really see the what he has to go through. Now, the other guy who lives in a shell, who's protected by all of these handlers, I mean, when are people going to wake up? And when they tell me, well, 34% of the country still thinks Joe Biden is doing a good job, I say, I just want to get a grip on this, because are these people certifiable? 34% of the people in this country think open borders, rampant crime in the streets, the degradation of our entire real estate system, inflation going crazy. You know, we gave up, we were energy independent under Trump, and we're not anymore. And they say he's in favor of the poor, and he is going to, you know, really be good for people. So what did he do? He bought a bunch of young votes by trying to kill their student loans, which they're going to get overturned again in the Supreme Court, probably. Who knows? But the idea is that people aren't listening. And I'm going to say one last thing, and I'll get off politics, because a lot of my book is not politics.
As you know, it's not political at all. Yeah.
It's an action thriller.
Yep.
But this poor young woman who was murdered the other day in Georgia.
Yes.
By this guy was an illegal immigrant, and her roommate came on the air. I don't know if you saw the interview. I got the chills because she literally said, you know, until this happened, I really didn't know that there was this problem about these people coming across the border. Now, this college student who was listening to CNN, MSNBC, NBC, they're not reporting what's going on. That's who she's listening to. She's not on Newsmax or Fox. That's not what she's listening to. She literally was stunned to learn there's a problem on the southern border. Now, you tell me, is this America? Really?
I mean, she probably doesn't even watch the news. I mean,
She's not watching what's really happening. I mean, Walter Cronkite is probably spinning in his grave. I mean, how about at least having a fair listen to what's happening here? And she literally said that her friend is dead. She's been murdered. Her skull has been deformed.
Yes.
And she says, I really didn't know this was such a big problem.
Yeah. You know, it used to be, and this is just immaterial or whatever, but there used to be a huge illegal alien population in Georgia. If I'm not mistaken, there probably still is. And because it was just a more welcoming place for a lot there. Plus, there were a lot of different industries that were hiring people that, you know, walked in and were willing to do whatever job they had. Yeah, and so it's kind of surprising she didn't know that. But on the other hand, we are in an information war, which is part of what your novel is.
That's what I'm saying.
About.
That's getting back to my book. By the way, the book is Enemies Among Us People, in case you forgot. And by the way, let me throw in one pitch, by the way. We're doing a short-term promotion, which is if you don't want to buy the hardcover, which I prefer that you do because I'm a hardcover book guy.
Yeah.
You can now buy the Kindle on Amazon for a limited time for $1.99.
Ooh.
Which is spectacular. Ooh. So Enemies Among Us, $1.99 on Kindle. I'm Jeffrey Stevens with a PH in Stevens. Go look it up. Go up, look up Enemies Among Us, $1.99. I'm telling you, money back guarantee, you will love the book.
You'll love the book.
Yeah.
Now,
I'm going to get that in there.
How do you keep up with tradecraft for your books? And also tradecraft, tech, and guns. How do you... Who are your people that you go to?
For guns, I have people who help. And there's one guy, quick, funny story. One of my earlier books, and he's just terrific. And, you know, he was in the service and he was a police officer. He's retired. So he looks at these things. So I send him the manuscript and he comes back to me and he says, you know that scene in the harbor of Portofino in Italy at the end? I said, yeah. He said, do you remember when the main character, the spy, in that book was Jordan Sandor? You remember when Jordan Sandor fires the I said, yes. He said, he fired 8 shots. That gun only holds 1 in the chamber and 6 in the magazine. And I had to go rewrite the scene. So I have people. I got to tell you something, Victor. I'm big on authenticity because I feel that people nowadays are so sophisticated, you cannot fool them. When I was a kid, I used to watch these Westerns, and the good guy would pull out his 6-shooter, get behind a rock, and fire off 30 shots at the bad guys without ever reloading. And you know, kid, okay, it's Gene Autry, it's Roy Rogers, you buy that. But now people are so sophisticated, and so every place that I write about, with a couple of rare exceptions, like I can't get into, you know, they won't let me in Syria because of the books I write. But, you know, if I'm portraying a restaurant in Paris, a restaurant in New York, a scene that takes place in London. I have been there and I am telling the truth about those places because readers will not let me get away with anything. So that's fun for me. I love when I hear back from people. In fact, folks, if you read anything of mine and you want to get in touch with me, my website is jeffreystevens.com, Stevens again with a PH. And there's an ability to get through. And I love to hear from people. Even if you have complaints, if you love it, wonderful. If you don't, you know, tell me what you didn't like. I'd love to hear those things.
I think it's great. I wrote a story the other day for PJ Media, and I just, because out of sheer habit from being in the business for so long, I said, I was talking about a cop using a gun. I go, service revolver. And oh, I got so much flack for that. I thought, oh, geez. And I, you know, it was a really good story. I just enterprised it myself, and which is what news probably should be. And anyway, it wasn't a derivative story. It was something I came up with myself. And then I just bashed myself in the head slap the forehead by saying revolver. And oh, I got so much flack for that. And I thought, oh, geez, read the rest of the story. He just anyway, we changed it, but it was just like, oh, they do care about gear. They care big time about gear. You also talk about a ghost chip.
Yeah.
That's
a fun subplot.
Yes. And that has run through the first novel in the series and this one, this current
one. That's right. That's
right. And so talk about where'd you get the idea for that?
Well, it's and I hate to say this even, but I admit this is an Elon Musk type character who develops these things. And so they're working on a ghost chip. And the point of the chip is that if you put it into an iPhone or, you know, any kind of smartphone or an iPad or something, it makes the conversation and the messaging completely untraceable. You cannot locate the device. And so it makes it easy for terrorists to suddenly communicate without being tracked. Because as you know, getting back to my story and what we do in the intelligence community, what we do is we track this chatter on the dark web. And that's how we find out things. And that's how we help prevent things happening. And we have people who infiltrate these groups in the dark web, whether it's Hamas or any of the other groups, not just Arabs, understand, Chinese and Russians and what have you. So the idea is that this chip would make it impossible to track them. And I thought that would be a pretty cool thing because I think we're getting close to that ability. And so that became a subplot, and I ran it right through into Enemies Among Us because it plays another role in the book.
Uh-huh. I think that VC firm, the CIA VC firm in Silicon Valley, is probably looking around for something like that, you know?
Hope I don't give any of the bad guys ideas. But yeah, that's been a fun part of the book too for me. And so I enjoy that part.
What has been the most shocking thing that the IC community has done in your lifetime?
Well, I hate to say this, but based on the book that I read, the claim that they were involved in the assassination of Kennedy, I mean, it's hard. This is written by a very, very brilliant guy. Gosh, what the heck? It's called something like The Impossible Truth, I think is the name of the book.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
and
no.
If you know that book, and I'm telling you that there were times when I really got tears in my eyes about what was happening and about how they played this and what they did and how people who were involved in this then wound up on the Warren Commission and then steered the investigation of the Warren Commission. So they said, oh, yeah, it was Lee Harvey Oswald. He acted alone, even though all evidence to the contrary, all evidence that shots came from different locations and that Lee Harvey Oswald, and I know people are going to scoff that I'm saying this. I don't want to be some crazy, you know, conspiracy theorist. I'm just telling you what's in this book. I didn't write the book. But they say it is impossible for Lee Harvey Oswald to have been there that day to shoot Kennedy because he was in the cafeteria of that building having an argument at the time. And so the timing was impossible. And he was just the dupe of all time. Now, again, I didn't write it. I'm just telling you what this book says. But if you read the book, it's pretty convincing that there are problems there. And I'm not saying Johnson was behind it because he wasn't. I don't think he was the guy. But there were people in the industrial military complex, as I said earlier, war was good business for them. And they wanted to fight with Khrushchev because they felt we could still beat them at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so that's probably the most upsetting thing because...
Yeah, murdering a cop? I mean, a president?
Death was. I remember my mother.
Oh, yeah.
I remember coming home. I was a little child, and I remember coming home from school, and my mother was sitting in front of the television weeping, and I said, you know, Mommy, what's the matter? And she said, the president is dead, and I couldn't even get my mind around it at that age. Yeah. And then you get older and older and you think, oh, well, this, that, and the other thing. And you just, oh, Lee Harvey Oswald and all this. And you believe what people tell you. And now I'm at the point in my life, I just don't believe anything at face value. You really have to investigate and see what's going on. Right? As
totally
you said
agree.
Earlier, hence the Russia hoax and all the rest of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you still have the same dumb reporters picking up and whatever they're throwing down and going, okay, but put it. Well, I don't even think they're that dumb. I think they just do it for job security whatever.
I'm not going to mention anybody in particular. Like I would never say Peter Alexander, for example, on NBC, but here's a good looking square jawed guy. And I'm telling you what, don't ask him to recite the alphabet. I'm sorry. He just moved that there. And he, if he had an original thought, it would die of loneliness. Each is one of many people out there. I just don't see that he ever brings anything to the table.
I have a question for you. Was there a reason why the bad guy was married to somebody in the State Department? Was that a tell of some sort?
Yes, you're giving something away, but yes.
Oh, no, yes. Did I? No, well, okay. We can take it out.
No, spoiler alert. No, leave it in. Oh. It's okay. It's okay, but yes.
I laughed when I said
just there are reasons. There are reasons. Yes, indeed.
Your bad guy is affiliated with a particular kind of bad guy group. Why that one?
It just fit. I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, you know, gosh knows there are a lot of bad guy groups, right? So you have choices. But I thought it fit. And the other thing, and this is very important for me, and I want to say this, and I don't want to sound pretentious because this book, again, folks, this is entertainment. It's exciting. It's fun. It's a page turner. Don't start reading it at 8 at night because you won't be able to go to sleep.
You won't be able to put it down.
Okay. But I'm just saying this, that I wanted the villain to be three-dimensional. And I think he is because too often, and again, I hark back to James Bond, and I think James Bond is so much fun and we all love it. But let's face it, when you've got Goldfinger or Dr. No, or what was the name of the crazy guy that Christopher Walken played in that movie when he played with Grace Jones, they're just two-dimensional. They're all horrible. There's not a good redeeming quality, but that's not real life. And I think that it's important to have interesting villains, because if your villains are boring, the story's not going to be good. Your villain almost has to be more interesting than your main character. Because otherwise, it's just like, ho-hum, he's a cartoon character, and let me just shoot him in the head and get this over with, But when, like, for example, there are scenes, as you know, in Enemies Among Us, with regard to this character who carries over from the handler, where there are very interesting conversations between Nick Reagan and this character. And I don't want to give any more away than that, but I think that people begin to see there are two sides of the story. So, that's always been said and it's true.
Mm-hmm. How intricately do you plan your characters? I've talked to people. We've talked to Don Bentley, who's taken over for the Vince Flynn franchise, and his predecessor, Kyle Mills. They game out where these kids went to elementary school and then they became who they are today. Do you go that far? What do you do?
I'd like to understand the background. By the way, I want to say this about the late Vince Flynn. I love Vince Flynn's books, and Vince Flynn was the first best-selling author to ever endorse me. And quick funny story about that.
So generous, that guy. Yeah,
he was
keep
so
going.
Great. But here's the funny story about this. This is going back some years because Vince is now gone. I met him at the International Thriller Writers Convention, and it was my first book. And my agent happened to know him, and he introduced us. We had a great conversation. Vince was a really, really sweet guy, as you know. And anyway, he said, okay, I'll take a look at this. So a couple of months went by. I didn't think anything of it. I got a call. I'll never forget this, on Thanksgiving Day. And my agent said, you're not going to believe this story. Vince has been so busy. And by the way, Vince, a lot of people don't know this. He had dyslexia.
I did know that.
Yeah,
yes.
So he had a hard time making the time to read your book, but he gave it to his mother. She read it. She loved it. She gave it to Vince's father. He loved it. And so I got a call on Thanksgiving Day because my agent, Bob DeForio, said, you're not going to believe this, but I got a call from Vince who said, my goodness, if my mother and father both loved it, I got to give this guy an endorsement. And he didn't give out endorsements easily, though. He was, he's very careful. And he gave me this great endorsement, and my book went on to be a bestseller, the very first book, Targets of Deception.
Awesome.
He was a sweetheart. When he died, that was so sad that was undiagnosed cancer. But anyway.
Well, no, he knew in advance, but it was
getting back to your question. I'm sorry to keep going on. Yeah. Getting back to your question.
I love it.
I outline a lot in advance. I like to know the plot, but I also like to leave enough leeway that if my character is walking down the street, at any moment he could take a left turn and go in a completely different direction plot-wise. So that's important. But in terms of who they are, I have to know who these people are. And so generally speaking, in addition to the main character that I've described, I base characters a lot, not completely, on people I know. And so, for example, Carol Gellos, who is Nick Reagan's partner, is a tough-as-nails CIA agent who was formerly in the military, who is based completely on the woman that I know. And if you met her, you would say, oh, what a lovely woman, a nice, you know, middle-aged, you know, housewife type, mother, so-and-so. The truth is, she is who she is in the book, and I base it on her. And she gets a big kick out of it because she knows.
Yes. Wow. So do you write one a year now? Is that where you're sort of striving to get to?
Some books take longer than others, but yes, mm-hmm. I've got... I'm working on the third book in the Reagan series, but I've also started a new series about a young lawyer in New York who's got a retired police detective who is sort of his mentor, and a situation occurred that enables them to really good deeds for people. I don't want to give a lot away because it's great. And so I've written that book, and we're looking for a publisher. And I'm almost done with the sequel to that book. And I think it's a terrific book. People will really love it. And it's a lot of fun, and it's a completely different direction. And so hopefully that gets out there soon. We just need a new publisher.
Okay. You need a new publisher because it's a different genre?
It's a different genre. And what I've done with Post Hill Press, they've been terrific for me. And but it's a different genre, and this is not what they do. And some big editors are looking at it right now. But if there's an agent out there who's interested in reading this book, it's called Murder, Money, and Marriage. It's a fun book. And it's out there. It's for sale.
That's awesome. That is awesome. Well, you know what? I think that this is putting a beautiful bow on this conversation. And I appreciate you coming on.
Well, thank you. This is so much fun talking with you. Anytime you'll need somebody to chat with, I'm available. We could talk about anything. This is delightful.
Oh, yeah, this has been great. Thank you so much for coming on the Adult in the Room podcast. And I really appreciate you, you know, just being so generous with your time. I've noticed that people in this space are very, very generous. And I don't know, who else do you admire in this genre of books?
Well, it's fun. I mean, it's fun. You know, who else do I invite? Well, in addition to Vince Flynn, mm-hmm. I used to like Daniel Silva. He became too political, but he is a good writer.
Yeah.
I very much like Greg Hurwitz. I think he's a very clever guy, the Orphan X series. And so he's a very smart guy, and he's very versatile. Mm-hmm. And the truth of the matter is I also read a lot of classic fiction.
Oh.
Because, you know, Hemingway, Fitzgerald, Mom, you know, that kind of stuff, Nabokov and so on. And I think people should read those because they're great books. Mm. I used to love Robert Ludlum. I mean, I know he's now... People don't even remember that Robert Ludlum wrote the original Bourne Identity book, which they've now had, you know, 17 spinoffs, but
sure.
He was the guy who did it. He's now gone.
Yeah.
But a lot of great writers out there. Steve Barry, by the way, Steve Barry's terrific. I don't know if you've ever heard of him.
No, I haven't, but I will.
Oh, he's a very, very talented writer, very smart guy, by the way. And so his stuff is well thought out. And believe this or not, because a lot of people, I mean, I don't know if he's written anything really terrific lately, but Dan Brown.
Yes.
You know,
he's a very sharp guy.
From the Da Vinci Code to Angels and Demons. And what was the other one after that that was good? Anyway, he's very good. So there are people out there to read. Let me tell you something. But of all of them, the guy that I like, and I met him, and he was a terrific, terrific guy in person, is Ken Follett. And the interesting thing about Follett is he's written a lot of suspense novels. Then he went back and started writing all these books, Pillars of the Earth, and all this thing about he's fascinated with cathedrals, by the way.
Oh.
But in person, he is one of the most fun guys. You wouldn't believe this, but he's hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
He's a hilarious Englishman.
Have you read any of I would love to do that because the family trip over to the UK, maybe he's got some things he writes about that
you
might
should get him on your show.
I would be
make
honored.
Last an hour.
I would be honored to get him on the show. Do you ever read any of Ben Coase's books by any chance?
I know who he is. I can honestly say I have not. I'm sorry.
I admire his first book, Power Down. I've read all his books, yeah. But Power Down.
Jack Carr. We left out Jack Carr.
Oh, I left out Jack Carr. And I just mentioned him last episode.
Mm-hmm. And Harlan Coben.
Yes, yes.
And so there are a lot of great writers out there. Let's face it. It's you know, and you know, they're all doing great things. And I wish I was up there with them in terms of sales, but not yet, but we're getting there. But you can buy the Kindle for $1.99, but it's only for 3 days. So get out there and do it.
Get out there and do it. Thank you so, so much, Jeffrey Stevens. I appreciate it. And
thanks. I hope we'll see you again.
Oh, yes, you will. Thanks for coming on the Adult in the Room podcast.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Adult in the Room podcast. To keep the programs you like to listen to, please rate this podcast with a fantastic 5 stars on your Apple Podcast app every time you listen. And give me a great review. Plus, of course, subscribe to the podcast. It makes a difference with the big tech algorithm and the big tech oligarchs, and it makes us easier to find. Please get in touch with me on all the big tech stuff. Yeah, we're still there. Using the names Victoria Taft or the Adult in the Room podcast on MeWe, Parler, Minds, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thanks to 1A Cast for imaging, editing, and production. The fantastic song is Gospel by the March 4th Band of Portland, Oregon. Music for Antifa versus Mike Strickland is Ride or Die by Raps by RC. The Adult in the Room podcast is also a production of Flamingo Road Studios. Remember, head up, heart out, and strive to be the adult in the room. Till next time, mischief managed.